Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Lodo. Thank you so much for coming tonight, and thank you so much for supporting independent bookstores and our author events. We really appreciate that. It's a great pleasure to introduce New York Times bestselling and award-winning author of the Thursday Next series and Shades of Grey novels and nursery mysteries, Jasper Ford, who will talk about One of Our Thursdays Is Missing, the newest in the series. He was an enthusiastic member of the film industry for 19 years before becoming published. He's author of 5 Thursday Next books, 2 nursery crime books. I think they might be more than that.
No?
Okay. And he's writing, I'm remembering wrong. And says that writing is the same as filming, really, only you do all the jobs and not just one. Currently lives and works in Wales with his families, and his hobbies include family and flying and photography. So please look for his photography, too. And if you haven't looked at his website, it's wonderful. It's just, you could spend all day on it. Please welcome Jasper Ford.
Well, thank you for that Denver welcome. I am in Denver, aren't I?
Yeah.
I am. Good. Phew. I get slightly confused because it's one city a day for 2 weeks. So half the time I don't know where I am. And if I'm sent off on a hub like to Atlanta or Memphis, I have absolutely no idea where I am. And usually I have to end up, if I'm speaking on the phone, I have to speak to the person next to me and I'd say, where am I? And she said, you're in Memphis. Anyway. Right. Well, so interesting thing. We just mentioned about my website, actually. This is quite fun because I was talking to someone, a website designer, which is always amusing to talk to about my website because it always requires me to make an apology because the website is kind of old-fashioned looking. And I was speaking to this website designer and I said, I'm sorry about the website. It's kind of rather old, isn't it? And he said, no, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's how we used to do. It's how we used to do websites, you know, back in the 14th century. You know, in like 2000, you know, in those long, distant, far-off times when there were like sort of 500,000 pages on the World Wide Web. Wow, do you remember that? And I remember Googling myself and only had 6 hits, which was quite exciting. So yes, the website is very, very old-fashioned. But this same designer said to me, no, it's kind of nice in a sort of classic kind of way. It really, really brings us back, real nostalgia hit. You know, drop-down menus, what were they? Frames, remember those? You know, my wife and I put it all together, and it's been slowly sort of spreading and darkening, and you can in fact find little nooks and crannies in that website that even I've forgotten I put there. So there's quite a lot of fun. We actually had to redo some bit of coding on something, and there were 986 pages, which is actually, so it's really like another 2 novels. So it can take you probably that long to go through it and enjoy all the spelling mistakes. Yeah, so we learned HTML version 1, I think it was in those days. And apart from introducing justified text in 2005, that's about the sum total of our advances. But most people say it's fine because it's great. All it is clickable links, pictures and text. What else do you need? What else do you need? Indeed. Anyway... on the website, I should be talking about this book, really. On the website, there is actually a sleuthing competition. This is something that we invented for Shades of Grey. And the problem was with running competitions, okay, is now it's very easy to find out answers about my books because you just go on Google, you know, and it's very, very easy. So I've been introducing these very, very difficult questions that require real brain power. And you'll find those on my website about one of our Thursdays. So if there's a particular question in the book that you think, now, why isn't that explained? It could possibly be one of the questions. So anyway, so I've had a few answers so far, but nobody's got all 10 questions correct. I'll just put on my glasses. Now, I think I have to say a huge thank you. That was the first thing I want to say from a grateful British people for taking Piers Morgan off our hands. We're just very, very grateful to you all for doing this. And of course, he's not the only one. You've also got Gordon Ramsay, I understand now. So we're delighted because the more you have them, the less we have to endure. And the same can be said of Simon Cowell as well. We are delighted that he spends more time now, you know, making money overseas rather than making money where we are. So if you could keep him, actually, try and get him a green card, you know. The Beckhams, I think, are still here, aren't they? Yeah, they're still here. Yeah, so you can have them as well. And Ricky Gervais as well. Please keep him. Please keep him. Anyway, so what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about the book, and a bit about sort of, you know, life and writing and everything, and also questions. I do like questions. Questions are great. They allow me to figure out how I wrote the books, which is a great way of doing it. Because generally, I had an interesting conversation actually with a guy on the radio, and he really was into the writing as, you know, this amazing sort of craft and everything, and was kept on wanting to highfaluting everything, you know, make it very, very complex. And I was going, no, it's not like that at all. If you're an author, a lot of it is just like making up weird and wonderful ideas and then thinking, oh, that'll work. And what about if I do this and that and everything? And it's much more scatter principle, or it is with me anyway. So oftentimes I write stuff, and then it's only when you guys ask me really sort of probing questions, like, why did you write that stuff, that I can go, yes, I wonder why I did, you know, or you know, why? How did you come up with the idea about Neanderthals, and where does all that stuff sort of come from? And so I do like a lot of questions, and hopefully we'll do sort of half an hour of talk and then half an hour of questions. Questions are great also because when you're asked a question, of course, I for many, many years now, whenever anyone asks me a question, no matter where it is, I always just ask any question. And this is something that I think everybody should do. For instance, if you're at a restaurant and the waiter, waitress has just explained, you know, what's on the menu, and then they say, do you have any questions? Right, then you should say, yes. Yes, I do, actually. Do you remember at the end of Star Wars? Why didn't Chewbacca get a medal? You know, or, and they go, what? And then you go, no, what? Okay, well, cancel that. Why is orange jam called marmalade? You know, I've always wondered. So when anyone says, do you have any questions? That's what you should do. Just anything that you've been really wanting to know for a very, very long time, you know. I'm answering questions in essentially what I do when I write books. I set myself a very tricky question, or a narrative dare, as I call it, and then I kind of write my way out of this narrative hole. And it's sometimes the ingenuity of having to write myself out of the hole that actually creates a new and exciting and perhaps slightly different and maybe even, dare I say it, original ideas that I've sometimes come up with. And that's a great way to write if you write in the sort of genre I write in. If you figured out what genre I write in, I'd very much like you to tell me afterwards because I have no idea, and it's frightfully embarrassing when I'm asked questions by journalists as to what genre I'm in because I don't know. Because unfortunately, you know, there is a little pecking order, I think you've noticed, within genres, and that some genres are more equal than others, and that if you say I write fantasy, then it's all about sort of goblins and spells, which clearly it isn't, but that's where people tend to put fantasy, which I think is wrong. Same with science fiction, they think of sort of ray guns and, you know, robots and twin suns, and it's not necessarily about that at all. So it's a tricky one, genre, and I consider it the sort of the measles of the book world. I think all books actually should be coded by something entirely separate than genre, such as colour. this would be a blue book and would sit in the blue section along with all the other blue books. And then, of course, you'd come in and you'd read a blue book like this, and you'd go to your bookseller and you'd say, that was a really good blue book. Do you have anything blue, but little maybe darker blue this time? And they'll go, yes, of course. And they'll give you an entirely different book that's entirely different genre. And then you'd go away and you'd read that and you'll be reading something completely different. One of the joys, and there are many joys in writing, I must say, and you know, talking to people about what they get from my books is clearly one of the biggest, is that they've used my books to actually find another genre, which to me is brilliant. Because I don't like this idea that, people say, oh, well, I only read crime, or I only read fantasy, or I only read sci-fi. I read everything, and my iTunes on Shuffle is ludicrous, actually. I always think that's kind of nice, and people say to me, I came to your book, from sci-fi, because somebody said, there was some alternative worlds and an alien, and then I realised it was about the classics, and I thought, these classics look rather fun. So I read Jane Eyre, and now I'm working my way through the Austen stuff. So I was hugely, I thought that was great fun, that, I must say. So we like questions, and again, asking myself questions is the way I like to write. Sort of narrative dares, if you like. Oh, I should ask, who hasn't read any of my books? Oh, we got a few here. Right, okay, so I should slightly try and modify my talk slightly, because I remember giving a talk once to almost an entire... Sometimes I do libraries in the UK, and then you get a far more preponderance of people who actually haven't read me at all. And then I give a talk thinking they know what I'm talking about, and they don't. And there's this kind of sea of confused faces until I suddenly pop the question and then go, ah, okay, difficult. So to those of you who haven't read the book, presumably you're here because someone you know, or a complete stranger, or a loved one, or something, has said you've got to read these books and stuff like that. And you have said, they have said, no, you have said to them, what are they about? And they've tried to explain and... And they've been playing the Jasper Ford role-playing game. Because that's what my life was like pre-publication, trying to explain my books to someone who has no idea what I'm talking about, and just sort of look at me with sort of crazed eyes. Suffice to say, I think, for those people who haven't read any of my books, is that I write three series, four actually. There's the Thursday Next series, which we're kind of going to talk about, if I ever get around to it. This is about the idea that fiction is a real world beyond the page, and that all the characters who exist in all fiction everywhere have little lives that they enact out when they're not actually being read. Because mischief and error are hardwired at inception within anything humans create, I always feel, there is mischief and an error within the book world, and there is a policing agency called Jurisfiction, which is there to set things right and hopefully keep books as the author intended. There was, just to give you a rough example, in Something Rotten, the fourth in the series, Hamlet has an excursion into the real world. Thursday lives in the real world, her real world. It's a sort of parallel world that isn't like ours, but, well, it is like ours, but more so. confused already. Hamlet comes into the real world because he's been he's rather worried that he's been misinterpreted as something, as a sort of ditherer, someone who sort of talks a lot and does very little, when in fact to himself he knows that he's this amazing sort of philosopher, poet, saint. Actually, he's just a prince, and of course princes can say what they want and everyone listens to them. We've got one of them. Actually, he's not that bad. He does tell a bit of, he doesn't always talk nonsense. But of course, when Hamlet is out in the real world, delighting at the fact that Mel Gibson plays him in the movie, the joke doesn't work quite so well now since he sort of fell from grace a bit. I'll have to, because that was 2004, and then I got a lot more laughs when I said that one last time. Anyway, I might move on from that. Anyway, so when he's out there, let's rewind there, delighting in the fact that he enters for a Hamlet competition and comes in fourth. Very embarrassing. He just wasn't Hamlet enough. A little too talkative, perhaps, it was. But what happens to his play when he is out in the real world is, of course, that all the other players in the play try to take over and rename it after themselves. Like, you know, the story, instead of, you know, the story of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, it's the story of Ophelia, who was cruelly cast aside by a very nasty person and had to kill herself. So you can imagine all the sort of, you know, fun and hijinks that go on. Anyway, that's one of them. The other series is the Nursery Crime series, which is a little perhaps easier to explain, only a little. And this is the idea that nursery rhyme characters are real, and their little nursery rhymes that they exist in are actually a sort of a motif for sort of crime, mayhem, and recrimination and despair, which they are, actually. If you think of Hansel and Gretel, not only do you have child abandonment with attempted murder, essentially, then you have the witch, of course, who keeps them against their will, right? And then it's fattening them up for potentially murder/cannibalism. And there's probably a lot of sort of building regulations about the house. built of cake, obviously. Bit of a problem in the rain, I should imagine. But anyway, so there you have a very, very terrifying story, which is fine for children because they love all that kind of stuff. And, you know, chopping off heads and hands and stuff. They love it. But it should be kept away from impressionable adults who could have a psychotic attack. So it's basically, it's the first in the series, Humpty Dumpty, is re-examining the curious incident of the egg that fell over in the night and how it broke. And, of course, has to be the murderer has to be uncovered. The second in the series, the fourth bear, is the re-examination of the curious incident of Goldilocks, who goes missing. And of course, this is a wonderful story, the three bears, and I'm, you know, amazed that no one has done this before. And of course, what we have first is an enigmatic blonde who goes missing. Now, that's the start of any good Chandler novel, to be honest, isn't it? She goes missing after trashing the house. So there's something going on there and sleeping in the beds. So very odd. But what this allowed me to do, and this goes back to the questions, of course, that I asked myself and also about narrative dares, is the problem I had with the three bears, and I was a very sort of questioning child, a very annoying child, I should imagine. I'm just now an annoying adult, so you can see how I've advanced over the years. And the question I always asked was, of course, first and foremost, is why were Mummy Bear and Daddy Bear sleeping in separate beds? Obviously, you know, sort of points towards marital discord within the bear family unit, and clearly there has to be a reason. Perhaps someone was playing away. Mummy Bear, Daddy Bear, don't know. But the other question, of course, in the three bears is the porridge problem. Now, I spotted this very early on when I was very, very small, and in fact, if you think about the porridge, because Daddy Bear's porridge, big bowl, too hot. Mummy Bear's porridge, medium bowl, too cold. Baby Bear's porridge, small bowl, just right. Okay, now from a thermodynamic point of view, this clearly does not stack up, and any detective worth their salt will instantly know that there is certainly a big problem within the whole three bear missing Goldilocks issue. And the entire book, if you reread my books on a regular basis, which I hope you do, you know, weekly perhaps, if you ever read the fourth bear, the next time you read the fourth bear again, or if you haven't read it and you do read it, bear in mind that this book essentially does one thing and one thing only, and that's explain away the porridge. that's all it does. Clearly, that's there is a little bit more to it in the book, because you could, in fact, explain it away within a paragraph. But the point about writing these sort of books is that I have to not only create this bizarre idea and this narrative dare, if you like, that about the three bears being, you know, these sort of basically like humans living in a little cottage in the middle of a forest. So there has to be a world in which this can actually happen. So I had to create a world in which this was not only likely but almost inevitable. And then, of course, I have to populate it with people who make sense and are engaging, and you can follow throughout the 100,000 words of the book, which I think is a good size for a book, and anything less is a little bit of a cheat, I think. Although, I personally like short books. But that is basically how I sort of set about writing a narrative dare and then get on with it. The narrative dare for the whole Thursday series, incidentally, was that Jane Eyre is kidnapped out of Jane Eyre and someone has to get her back. That was it, essentially. Everything else is secondary to that single idea. Every notion, every character basically is there to try and explain away that particular question of what happens and that narrative dare. Thursday sort of arrived after the initial idea. I had her name. I wanted a female character, protagonist, because the first two books I'd written had been a male protagonist. So I looked in my list of silly names, which I actually do have, and I saw Thursday Next, and I thought that's the name for me, because it has a lovely internal rhythm to it. Di-dum-di-dum, Thursday Next. It's enigmatic. What kind of woman would that be? And also, it just sounded right in this kind of funny sort of way. And then I just said, right, she's a detective. Let's think, well, Jane Eyre probably wouldn't be, the book Jane Eyre probably wouldn't be, you know, the idea of kidnapping Jane Eyre wouldn't be so big in our world. So actually, let's make a world where things literally is that much more important, and what does that entail? So we'll explore that idea. So all the world sort of spread and darkened just to make what happened actually believable. And astonishingly enough, 5 books later, I'm still at it. The jumping off point, I suppose, for the whole of the series, the Thursday Next series, was the creation of this book world and the jurisfiction that looked after it. So essentially, if I have to choose a genre for these, I suppose there'd be a sort of crime thriller, maybe you say literary crime fantasy thriller or something. Or maybe, I don't know. Someone said they're fiction, which is quite nice. Or metafiction, which makes it sound a little bit falluting, I think, a bit special. I don't know, I just say, you know, general fiction, really. Absurdist. Shall we have absurdist? I don't know. Anyway, so I wrote up this idea about the book world, and it's great fun, and we managed to make that last 5 books so far. The thing about this book is, apart from being almost the only book in which the title actually explains what the book's about, most of my books don't, they just like the titles. It's also, I think, the first real sequel, so for people here who haven't read me, you probably might be well advised to start with one of the others, because I thought, well, since it is number 6, TN6 I call it, I think I have to assume that a few people who are going to buy this have actually read the originals, so I did kind of do a little bit less revision maybe this time. But I have bumped into people who have read this without reading the others, and they were okay, which was very nice of them. A little bit confused to begin with, but they got on with it and it was fine. It's also a spin-off novel. I don't want to say too much about that for anyone who hasn't read it yet, but it actually takes place almost entirely in the book world, and it really examines kind of what it's like to be a fictional character, because the hero of this story is not Thursday Next, who is in fact missing, but the written Thursday Next, who is anything but missing and exists in the fictional world of the book world, but in Thursday Next fictional book world. Yes? Running her series of books, the Thursday Next books, but the fictional Thursday Next books, which aren't the same as these Thursday Next books, which are in our world. It's so simple, isn't it, when you think of it like that. Luckily, readers, the elasticity of readers' imaginations are sufficient to encompass all of this and more, so I felt I was in very good hands to actually write this sort of sort of inverted meta fiction. It does kind of work. So it is a bit of a spin-off book in that respect, that it's about, you know, a character who is not perhaps a central character, but wants to be the central character. It's still confusing, I know. So Thursday is missing. The peace talks are going on, because up in racy novel, the genre of racy novel, which, if you remember, was bordered between with feminism on one side and outdated ecclesiastical dogma on the other. And just down to the south, they border with comedy, and I think there's a buffer zones of bedroom farce and bawdy romp, or the de-comedized zone, as they call it. And he's been causing trouble. Speedy Muffler is the name of the senator who runs Racy Novel. And Racy Novel, of course, is part of the axis of unreadable, along with Misery Memoirs and any book with Hug in the title. So the cause of trouble, peace talks are needed, and Thursday, of course, is desperately needed to lead the peace talks, because she's now a jurisfiction veteran, but she's nowhere to be found. Sadly, jurisfiction do not have the assets to look after her. She could be behind any comma in any one of the half billion books in the book world, and they simply can't find her. However, the written Thursday does want to find her, and it's really her adventure that this is all about. But it's also about her really wanting to be perhaps a little bit more like her written namesake, because she's not terrible terribly well written, and she wants to be more like the real Thursday. And that's about that's her quest within the book, is not only to find Thursday, but find herself, which is Thursday. It's about a woman trying to find herself and herself. So it's a curious little amalgam, but I hope you'll enjoy it nonetheless. The book world, I felt, wasn't quite into the book world in a really good way. The book world is slightly clunky in the previous books, which I apologise for. So I decided to just leap in and change the book world and make it much, much more understandable. So what I've done is actually made it into a geographical book world. And there is actually now a map in the book, which is great. Look at that. And that means I am now a truly fantasy author. Because apparently that is the definition of a fantasy author, if you have a map in your book. So all the genres are all laid out, and you can see how to travel around, and it's quite amusing. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read a little short extract, which is about the written Thursday, just after the book world is remade. The thing about the fictional world, of course, is that it can be remade however it wants to be. The Council of Genres, which is the bureaucracy that oversees fiction and book world in general, just decided that since imagination was deregulated in the 50s, the outpouring of fictional works have actually really sort of caused a lot of problems within how the whole fictional thing works. So they decided to completely remake the book world. But they did need to do it in 9 minutes. They needed to find 9 minutes when no one was reading, or, you know, less than 20,000 people on the planet. So what they did is they just chose when the croquet super hoop was on, because it was a real biggie. It was between the Swindon Mallets and the Gloucester Meteors. I should mention, for anyone who hasn't read the books, that croquet is in fact the sport of choice in Thursday's world. This kind of mixture of croquet, rollerball, and American football all rolled into one. Very dangerous contact sport. And you have on your team two lawyers who can actually argue the points of the game as the game is in play. And then you actually have to have a high court judge to actually sit in judgment, and the play stops while they argue it between the lawyers. It's actually quite amusing. great fun to write, I have to say. Yes. If only the world was beyond satirizing. Sadly it isn't. We're now getting to the point where our soccer league now, they make decisions and they end up in the High Court. It's rather sad, really. But there you go. It's only a game, but it isn't. That's the point. Okay, so this is when Written Thursday is witnessing the new remade book world for the first time. I stood up and noticed for the first time that my living room seemed that little bit more realistic. The colours were subtler and the walls had an increased level of texture. More interestingly, the room seemed to be brighter, and there was light coming in through the windows. It was real light, too, the sort that cast shadows, and not the pretend stuff we were used to. I grasped the handle, opened the front door, and stepped outside. The empty inter-book nothing that had separated the novels and genres had been replaced by fields, hills, rivers, trees and forests, and all around me the countryside opened out into a series of expansive vistas with the welcome novelty of distance. We were now in the southeast corner of an island perhaps 100 miles by 50 and bounded on all sides by the Tech Sea, which had been elevated to grade 4 picturesque status by the addition of an azure hue and a soft billowing motion that made the text shimmer in the breeze. As I looked around, I realised that whoever had remade the book world had considered practicalities as much as aesthetics. Unlike the real world, which is inconveniently located on the outside of a sphere, the new book world was anchored on the inside of a sphere, thus ensuring that horizons worked in the opposite way to those in the real world. Farther objects were higher in the visual plane than nearer ones. From anywhere in the book world, it was possible to view anywhere else. I noticed, too, that we were not alone. Stuck on the inside of the sphere were hundreds of other islands very similar to our own, and each a haven for a category of literature therein. About 10 degrees upslope of fiction, I could see our nearest neighbour, artistic criticism. It was an exceptionally beautiful island, yet deeply troubled, confused, and suffused with a blanketing layer of almost impenetrable bullshit. Beyond that were psychology, philately, and software manuals. But the brightest and biggest archipelago that I could see upon the closed sea was a scattered group of genres that made up non-fiction. They were positioned right on the other side of the inner globe, and so were almost directly overhead. On one side of the island, the cliffs of rationality were slowly being eroded away, while on the opposite shore, the sands of science were slowly reclaiming salt marsh from the sea. While I stared upwards, open-mouthed, a steady stream of books moved in an endless, multi-layered crisscross high in the sky. But these weren't books of the small paper and leather variety that one might find in the outland. These were the collected settings of the book, all bolted together and connected by a series of walkways and supporting beams, cables and struts. They didn't look so much like books, in fact, but more like a series of spiky lumps. While some one-room dramas were no bigger than a double-decker bus and zipped across the sky, others moved slowly enough for us to wave at the occupants, who waved back. As we stood watching our new world, the master copy of Dr. Zhivago passed overhead, blotting out the light and covering us in light dusting of snow. "What do you think?" asked Whitby. "Oh, brave new book world," I whispered, as I gave him a hug that has such stories in it. So there you go, a little idea about how the new book world works, which is a much better way, I think. And also for future books, it opens up a whole new panoply of ideas and geopolitical satire that I can play with. I did mention Whitby there. This is Whitby Jett, who is the Written Thursday's DLI, or Designated Love Interest, of which you do have to have in the book world. Whitby is not without problems. Since this book is about characters and what it's like being read and the problems that characters have, one of his major problems is he doesn't have a backstory. Now, if having no backstory was his backstory, that would be okay, because then he'd be like a sort of mysterious man of mystery. But he doesn't even have that, so clearly it's a problem that has to be resolved at some point. Unfortunately for him, as regarding backstories, the thing about if you have a very bad backstory, it can very seriously cramp your style when it comes to dating possibilities. So a friend of his, whose name I don't recall now, and I've been saying that every single time I give him a talk, I should really look it up, but I always forget. A friend of his does have a backstory, but it's rather a bad backstory. And the backstory is that he set fire to a busload of nuns that were taking their orphaned puppies to an orphan puppy competition. And obviously having that sort of backstory is a big problem when you're trying to get a date, because, you know, just people don't like that kind of stuff for obvious reasons. So what this friend of Whitby says is, he said, "Listen, Whitby, me old chum, will you just take my backstory just for the weekend, because, you know, I want to go on a date and I can't do it with, you know, the burden of the guilt and everything, and I just hear the constant flames and the yipping of puppies and it's terrible. But if you could have that just for the weekend, it'd be great, and you know, you don't have to do anything, don't go out, just stay in, you know, get drunk and eat a pizza or something, and, you know, will you do that for me?" And of course, Whitby, he's a nice guy, so he says yes. But then what happens is his friend skips town, leaving him with the backstory, which isn't sort of very good news, because of course when you swap backstories in the book world, you have it for real. It is yours and you did it. But of course, when Written Thursday finds out that he set fire to a busload of nuns, clearly this is a big downer in the DLI, Designated Love Interest. These are the sort of problems we deal with in the book world on a daily basis. Just gives you a little idea of the sort of complexities and fun we can have with the whole writing idea. What we're doing, all right. Okay, in this endeavour, finding out what has happened to the real Thursday next, the fun bit about this is, of course, it brings me back to a Thursday that perhaps I enjoyed slightly better in the Lost in a Good Book and in Well of Lost Plots, where the book world is slightly confusing and she doesn't understand what's going on and she has to be led around a bit by Miss Havisham. And this Thursday is, again, slightly hesitant, so I've sort of gone back to that kind of vulnerable Thursday, which I think I quite kind of enjoy. And also it means I can add all sorts of new characters. And the person who is helping her in her endeavours is a clockwork butler called Sprocket. I like the idea of having butlers, I must say. I think it's a good thing. I think more people should have butlers. But, of course, having clockwork sentience is great fun as well, because you can play with that kind of idea as well. He's a Mark V duplex model, so he can't really show any emotions, and he doesn't really understand what compassion is. And because he can't actually display any emotions, he has a pointer. His eyebrow is actually a little steel pointer that just points to whatever he's feeling, and then it's easy, and just his pointer just goes ding to happy, or ding to peeved, or if things are really bad, it goes from, I think it goes from mildly peeved to very peeved, because he's obviously been made in England. Yes, because our sort of you know, levels of threat for the British go from sort of, you know, miffed up to extremely miffed and then to peeved, which means, you know, that a war is imminent. Anyway, so we can have a bit of fun with Sprocket. Now I'll read you another little section here, and this is when. Written Thursday brings Sprocket back to her series. Of course, all the characters in the series are the characters that you might recognise from the Thursday books. But of course, they're just actors playing those characters, so they're entirely different in real life as they are in the books. My books, not the books, fictional books. It's so simple, isn't it? For instance, Pickwick, whom you know and love, of course, is not, you know, a silent kind of slapstick fool in the sort of mould of the great sort of 20s slapstick figures, but is actually a rather annoying know-it-all who can't stop talking and everyone's fed up with. So that's quite amusing. I quite like that idea. Anyway, so there is all these characters, but they're all entirely different. Anyway, so this is Bowden. So this is the fictional Bowden talking. It's so complicated, I can't tell you. When Sprocket comes back, and Sprocket has been rescued from conspiracy. Written Thursday went into the conspiracy genre just to sort of deal with something, and of course they're all a bit odd in conspiracy, as you might imagine. Anyway, and they were just about to stone the robot because they thought he was part of a larger plot to take over the world and steal people's minds and the usual. Okay, so said Bowden, "Who's your friend?" "Sprocket," I replied, "my butler." "I didn't know you needed a butler," said Bowden. "Everyone needs a butler." And I think that's probably one of the truest statements I've ever written, actually. Life would be so much easier, wouldn't it? If you're in the shower and you've got a bit of soap in your eye and just put out your hand and you get past a towel. I mean, you just have a butler, just standing by. I have my butler here, just standing there, you know, just in case. Or just to lend tone to the proceedings. Don't actually have to do anything. Just stand there, you know, looking dignified. Everyone needs a butler. He was going to be stoned, so I took him with me. "What do cog-based life forms get stoned with?" asked Bowden in an impertinent manner. "Vegetable oil?" "Actually, sir," intoned Sprocket, "it's sewing machine lubricant for a mild tipple." "Many feel that the exuberant effects of 3-in-1 are worth pursuing, although I have never partaken myself. For those that have hit rock bottom, where life has become nothing more than a semi-conscious slide from one partial to the winding, from one partial winding to the next, it's WD-40. Well, I can go on, actually. Said Bowden, who had been put firmly in his place by Sprocket's forthrightness. "I see." Said Asheron, peering at Sprocket's data plate with great interest. Are you the duplex 6? 5, sir. The 6's release has been delayed. A series of mainspring failures have put beta testing back several months, and I now hear the 6 has pressure compensation issues on the primary ethical escapement module. What does that mean? I have to admit I'm not entirely sure, sir. The main problem with clockwork sentience is that we can never understand the level of our own complexity, for to do so would require an even greater level of complexity. At present, we can deal with day-to-day maintenance issues, but all we can ever know for sure is that we function. We tick, therefore we are. So there you go, bit of fun. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.